You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 106. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'm your host. And today we are talking about the archaeology of Indigenous South America. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nuuch, or Ute Peoples, treaty lands, the Dene Ta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. So today we have Dr. Jose Capriles Flores on the show. Dr. Capriles was born in La Paz, Bolivia. After receiving an undergraduate degree in archaeology at the Universidad Mayor de San Andres, he attended Washington University in St. Louis, where he received an MA and PhD in anthropology. He was a visiting scholar at the University of Pittsburgh and a Fondacit postdoctoral scholar at the Universidad de Tarapacá in Chile. He started as an assistant professor at Penn State in 2016. He's an anthropological archaeologist specialized in environmental archaeology, human ecology, and zooarchaeology, with special interests in the development of socio-environmental systems in the Atacama Desert, the Andean Highlands, and the Amazonian tropical lowlands. So welcome to the show, Dr. Capriles.
Thank you, Jessica. I would also like to acknowledge that the Pennsylvania State University campuses, where I'm talking to you from, are located on the original homelands of the Erie, Haudenosaunee, Lenape, Monongahela, Shawnee, Susquehannock, Wazazi nations. And as a land-grant institution, we acknowledge and honor the traditional caretakers of these lands and strive to understand and model their responsible stewardship. We also acknowledge the longer history of these lands and our place in that history.
All right. Thank you. Well, I am super excited to have you on the show. As I was saying before we got started, we can get a little North America heavy. So I'm very excited to talk about your work in South America. But before we get to the details of the work that you're doing, could you give us a little bit of background on what got you interested in this field?
Sure. Actually, another acknowledgement that I would like to make is that today is actually my mom's birthday. And although she passed away a few years ago, I guess I wouldn't be here both physically, but also, you know, academically without her, you know, care and influence. So, you know, in large part, I'm here because of my mom. She was a biologist and an ornithologist. And, you know, growing up, because of the career path that she had, we traveled a lot in Bolivia, various places. And I got to, you know, visit some amazing landscapes. Mostly my mom was interested in looking at birds and other animals, but, you know, the landscapes and the people and trying to make sense of these very diverse places have been sort of the reason why I subsequently got into archaeology, and I'm still fascinated by the deep history of people and their environment, particularly in South America.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever, when you were on those trips, did you ever experience any archaeology? Was there like a kind of a first memory that you have?
Yeah, definitely. We got to visit Tiwanaku when I was very young. I visited the site many times. This is one of the most important pre-Inca sites. It's a large site that has a lot of terraced temples and pyramids built with carved stone and adobe. It has a lot of stone monolith sculptures. It has some beautiful polychrome pottery. And it's located, it's about 72 kilometers from La Paz, so it's not very far away. And yeah, just experimenting, visiting that site, looking at the monumental, you know, accomplishment that people had in the past, but also at the looting that many of these places have suffered and the little that we know about them really motivated me to start learning more and start questioning what we know about these places and can we learn some more.
Okay, so you wanted to learn more based on your experiences with that site. How did you go about doing that? Like, what was your next step?
Yeah, I gotta say, I was very motivated from high school even to, you know, start reading up about basically anything that I could about basically the pre-Columbian past, the pre-Hispanic past of the Andes. And fortunately, in La Paz, at Universidad Mayor de San Andres, they had the option of archaeology as a professional career. So I signed up and, you know, enrolled in that program. And it was, you know, marvelous experience. Met great mentors, great peers. And because it was really the only, and still is the only program in archaeology in the country, there were many opportunities to engage and participate in various research projects, many of them run by foreign researchers, North American projects. And it was thanks to those opportunities that I was really encouraged to sort of apply to graduate school here in the U.S. And yeah, it's been kind of that. It's been kind of a pretty straightforward, pretty direct pathway, that I must say. Although, you know, I mean, it seems like it was straightforward, but there were a lot of like just a lot of experiences and a lot of interactions that really helped me sort of become the scholar that I am.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, spoiler alert from the intro, you went to Washington University in St. Louis for your MA and PhD. Why did you choose there specifically?
Yeah, I had a good friend, Maria Bruno. She was a graduate student at the time who I got to meet in Bolivia, and she really encouraged me to apply to that school. There was a professor, David Broman, who had excavated a site, a famous site called Chiripa in Bolivia. This is a pre-Tiwanaku site. It is one of the earliest sites that has some level of sort of religious architecture, specifically a sunken court that is surrounded by a series of structures that have double walls and beams in these walls. And it's just a very interesting early site for sedentary agricultural populations in Lake Titicaca, and kind of that's what eventually triggered sort of the emergence of the state of Tiwanaku. So David Broman had worked at the site in the 1970s, and you know, was very knowledgeable about Andean archaeology. Of course, he's worked in various other places as well, and among other things, pastoralism. And WashU at the time also had Fiona Marshall as a zooarchaeologist. And as an undergraduate, because, you know, the influence of my mom, I was really interested in animal resources and what they could, the information that they could provide to sort of enrich what we knew about the past. You know, most scholars were kind of interested more in social or political organization, kind of these big, apparently big level sort of aspects of these societies. But to me, I thought I was more interested in sort of their environment, their economy, their resources. And so having the possibility to study with, on one hand, an Andean specialist in David Broman, but on the other hand, a methodological specialist like Fiona Marshall, who had studied pastoralist societies, but in Eastern Africa, really, really motivated me. And it was thanks through their mentorship, but other professors there, that I kind of was able to really grow and develop in that direction. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how did you know which animals you specifically wanted to focus on? Or has it changed through time?
Right. So, well, the Andean highlands obviously have a few very important animals, and of them all, obviously South American camelids, their domesticated varieties, the llamas and the alpacas, but also the wild ones, the vicuñas and the guanacos, are, you know, by far the most significant ones. So, but of course, there are other resources. There's a number of really interesting aquatic birds, highland birds, including various species of flamingos, of teals, of coots, of egrets, all sorts of interesting birds. There's also fish in places like Lake Titicaca, a number of different native species. And through my master's, I actually focused on studying fish remains. But fundamentally, a lot of the societies in the Andes relied on pastoralism of llamas and alpacas. And so to me, it became, you know, one of the questions that I had was basically related to trying to understand a little bit more about how the first pastoralist societies emerged and developed in this region. So that's what I tried to do in my doctoral research. I did a survey in a region close to the modern town of Oruro in the Bolivian highlands. Again, this is a region that is quite arid, and even historically, it's been a place where to this day there is a number of indigenous communities that still rely on their herds for a lot of their economy. And so I was interested in learning more about their deeper past. So we were able to do some work in that direction and, you know, really open up more questions because there's still so much to learn.
Mm. Yeah. So could you talk a little bit more about that aspect of like the community? And well, I guess first, like, I mean, is the way that they practice their livelihoods or the relationship to, you know, these animals, is it like the same, different as the what you're studying in the archaeological record? Are they connected to that archaeology? Like, are they descendants, or is it more like that they're not really like directly connected to the people that were in the archaeological record that you're studying?
Sure. Very, you know, fascinating questions. Well, in this region, we believe that they are indeed connected. They are several hundreds, if not thousands of years of sort of development of various pastoralist strategies, beginning during the process of domestication, probably, well, archaeology. What we found is that there are indeed a number of archaic period sites, so we can call them pre-pastoralists in many ways, but these are sites of hunter-gatherers, highland foragers that were procuring wild camelids as part of their subsistence. And it's through this interaction that eventually they began to manage these herds, starting about 3,500 years ago, more or less. There's a transformation. Instead of these groups recurrently moving and hunting these animals, they began to have sort of more recurrently visited spaces. These are sites that currently look like mounds. They're not very large, typically less than a hectare, but they are formed by overlapping occupations of basically residences of herders. They have some residential structures, but they also have corrals for penning the animals. Sometimes they also have some burials associated with them. We believe that those burials were important because they likely helped them to legitimize territorial control over those locations, but also the grazing grounds around them. And they were also procuring other wild resources. Again, some of those birds, some rodents, wild guinea pigs, amongst others. And they were largely decentralized. Eventually, the Tiwanaku state sort of incorporated this region into sort of its expanding influence. So we see a little bit of hierarchy arriving to this region. We see some changes in terms of use of the space. And then after Tiwanaku, there's a disintegration of this region. But today's descendants are in large part historically connected with those post-Tiwanaku communities, people that we know historically through the names of people like Karangas or the Sor. And the communities today, they've changed, of course. Certainly the European, and specifically the Spanish sort of invasion and conquest, also brought significant changes, including bringing in new animals. And so pastoralists today often have sheep. They often have other some old world animals, sometimes donkeys, sometimes cattle. And so of course, they're more integrated with more broader market economies. We know that, you know, beginning in during this post-Tiwanaku period, but from Tiwanaku, the caravans of llamas were very important in this region. And so there's all of these connections and resources that were exchanged from various other neighboring ecological regions. Those were largely facilitated through these caravans of llamas. But nowadays, of course, you know, it's more the use of trucks. And and so there's all of these changes that have occurred in terms of technology, in terms of again, market integration, but the communities still have some elements of these sort of longer horizons, these longer connections with those deeper pasts. And we see that in terms of ritual, though ritual itself has also been sort of become ways is syncretism with sort of the Catholic religion, but many elements connected to sort of the trying to foster the fertility and the reproduction of the herds are still very important for these people in these communities.
Wow. Okay. So there's so many questions I want to ask, but we are already at our first break point. So when we come back, I'd love to continue and dive a little bit deeper onto the last portion that you were just talking about. So we will be right back after a quick break. Okay, so when we left off, we were talking a little bit about the current Indigenous communities in the area where you were working during your master's, I believe, right? During grad school, at least.
And yeah, the doctorate, really, yeah.
Doctorate, okay, sorry. And you were talking a little bit about ways that traditions have stayed the same and ways that they've been changed in large part to the Spanish. And I'm really curious to hear, you know, if the community feels connected to these archaeology sites, if they like recognize their connection to these past communities. If not, yeah, what is the perspective on this?
Right. Yeah, so to some extent, they are connected with their landscape, and the landscape is complex, and the sites are part of that complex landscape that in many ways it is has various aspects of sacredness, and but it also has some aspects that are economic. So it is complex. Indeed, they have an idea of what a narrative of the past, influenced to some extent by schooling, but you know they see themselves as part of sort of a multi-generational inheritance of their livelihood and their spaces that they occupy. So we as archaeologists engage on that and try to sort of provide information that is just by, you know, because we collaborate them, we learn from them, but also we're trying to show how archaeology can inform of what, you know, this landscape was back in time. So, you know, specifically the three communities that I worked for my dissertation project were Iroko, Chusakeri, and Cochiraya. These are communities located somewhat close to the city, modern city of Oruro. So there's a lot of migration out of the communities. At the time, you know, very few people were still there, but we got to work with some of their, you know, their descendants in the sense that some of the, well, through sort of their systems of social organization and political organization, have them participate. And so a few members of the community actually actively participated in a project. And it was a very positive, and at least to me, it was a great experience. And but this varies in other regions in various and complex and diverse ways. So, you know, typically when we start projects, particularly in new regions, part of our process is really connecting with those, both community leaders, but also just residents of these places, and basically consulting with them if they're, you know, interested in doing research and kind of having them be, you know, collaborators and contributors to this process. And yeah, that's... It becomes a lot more rewarding in that way, because you're not just doing archaeology for an academic, you know, with an academic goal, but you also are sort of providing information that the people use and they also they can take advantage of and appropriate. And it's become quite rewarding working in this regard. So.
Yeah. Could you maybe give an example from one of your projects, either like how that played out or a way that really, you know, felt special, meaningful?
Yeah. So I mentioned the site of Chiripa a little while ago. So we've been working on and off of this on this site for a number of years, and with two great collaborators, Christine Hastor from the University of California, Berkeley, and also Maria Bruno, who I mentioned before, who was a graduate student at the time at WashU. We've continued to do some work over the years. Our most recent field project in Chiripa, funded by the NSF, involved conducting more excavations in the site with the goal of really exploring the earliest context of the site, where we see sort of early domesticates, particularly quinopods, quinoa, potatoes, but also llamas. And again, this is about 3,500 years ago. The site has long occupation, but we're really interested in these early contexts. So we did, you know, two seasons of excavations, 2022 and 2023. But through that work, we sort of engage in not just the excavations themselves, in which pretty much everybody in the community participated in, but a series of trainings, particularly for really motivated individuals. This site has increasingly sort of been developing various initiatives related to becoming a small sort of touristic center in a way. It's close to Tiwanaku, it's close to the city of La Paz. Through the project, we were able to sort of improve a little bit of the exhibition spaces that they have in there. They have a small museum. There's also a nice former hacienda building that has been restored. And this is through various initiatives, not just our project, but the community has really been working with their municipality. And they've been really interested in developing themselves as a place of, as having archaeology and some form of archaeological tourism as an additional potential source of income for the community, but also it is very important in their own identity. So at Tatsunken Court, every year on the winter solstice, June 21st, they have a really wonderful music festival, and they have various activities that they carry out, and we're there sort of training them. We present talks to all of the students. They have a local school, middle school and high school, and so we're constantly interacting with them, trying to support them, but also trying to sort of facilitate as much information as we have about the site. And we, for instance, developed Christine, particularly a graphic novel with John Swager, which has been translated into Spanish, but also to Aymara, which is sort of the native language that still most people in Chiripa speak. And it's a graphic novel based on what we've been able to learn from investigating the site for a number of years. It tells the story. It's kind of like a coming of age story about a little girl whose mother dies, and eventually she becomes as some form of healer. And again, it's a story placed at the site, and you can see how the community has really responded very positively. Their connection to the site has only increased because of that. And also the protection, the preservation, giving more value to archaeological sites. Of course, in all of these communities, there's a big push for development, for building, you know, better roads, for building infrastructure. And for us, it's important to do that, you know, balancing also the protection of their cultural heritage, the protection of some of those ancient sites. And through sort of these activities and sort of that collaboration, we've been trying to sort of do both.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's super cool. The graphic novel, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, no, it's a great way, you know, to sort of distill some of the more abstract knowledge that we're sort of generating and make it, you know, widely available. And so we distribute it to every single student and every single person who's worked in our project, there's been a lot of people, you know, a physical copy. There's also digital copies online that were being widely shared. And we're in the process of making another one for a different project. And we see that as also important doing dissemination, not just, you know, the part of doing the research, but also making sure that eventually everything that we do also returns in a way that is accessible to the people that have helped create this knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think another thing that you said right there that's really important is you were talking about balancing development with preservation. And this is something that's come up in past episodes. I remember talking to Jason Nez on all the way back in episode 3 about balancing development and preservation on the Navajo Nation, just right down the street from me in Arizona, Utah, New Mexico, where obviously, the archaeology on the Navajo Nation is just insane. But also, there's people still to this day, large numbers living without running water, electricity, and the very real impacts that has on, you know, health and safety. And so I think it's an important point that it's easy, those of us anthropologists in the U.S., to get really caught up on the preservation side and forget the importance, the very real, you know, importance of development to the people that we're working with.
Yeah. And, you know, for countries like Bolivia, who've been, you know, are still lagging in many ways in a lot of this infrastructure, it's very paradoxical because, you know, development, it's what people really want, is what they, you know, need in a very sort of, in a very real sense. But it often results in the loss of a lot of their cultural heritage, of their sense of identity, their belonging. But it's not necessarily easy to identify these things as they're happening. So that's why for us, dissemination is so important, because transmitting the significance of engaging with cultural patrimony, but also investigating that patrimony is important. And unfortunately, we can only do it in a limited number of places, but we hope that, you know, these are at least sort of examples that can also sort of be contagious to other places and other communities. And to some extent, we see it happening. There's definitely a lot of community leaders that have approached us that they want to do sort of research in their own communities, in their own places. And it opens up a really interesting opportunities for, especially for new generations of archaeologists as well, especially those trained in these countries, in Bolivia, for example, and other neighboring countries as well.
Mm-hmm. And I believe, if I remember correctly, you are working with students in Bolivia as well, correct?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, yes. Yeah, it's very important when you carry out research to not only carry out, not only accomplish research goals, but train future and professionals that can engage with that patrimony is equally important, especially if we bring in students, which sometimes we do from the U.S. We typically pair them up with Bolivian students, so they have their peers, they can interact with each other, they learn, you know, mutually from these dialogical relations. It becomes such a more enriched environment thanks to it. And it opens up all sorts of interesting possibilities. Many students then from the U.S., want to perhaps conduct research projects in the Andes. I'm also happy to say that I have a Bolivian graduate student here at Penn State. And so the idea, and I've also brought students from Chile to Bolivia, and also Bolivian students to Chile, and North American students to all of these places. So, but, you know, in many ways, is the idea of just interacting and building networks of collaboration is something that we also enjoy and like to participate on fostering.
Okay, we're right at the end of this segment, but I just have to ask, I'm curious logistically, like when you bring students from the U.S. down to Bolivia to work with Bolivian students, like, are they communicating in English, Spanish? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Spanglish, I would say. Yeah, Yeah, it's a process, you know. Young students want to learn English, they want to sort of, you know, they see English movies all the time. They also read a lot of the literatures in English. So they have incentives for learning English, and being able to, you know, engage with native speakers is very valuable for them. At the same time, for, you know, U.S. students, yeah, being able to be down there is an opportunity to improve their language skills, their Spanish, and yeah, often see them, you know, picking up various words and so on. And but the best way to do that is, in my experience, has been having them interact amongst themselves, not just with the professors.
Yeah. And I would hope that if it was a U.S. student wanting to do work in Bolivia or Chile, that they would be wanting to learn the language anyway, in order to do it the way, you know, to the level that they should be doing it at. Mm-hmm. On that logistical note, we are at our second break point. So we will be back here in a second for our third and final segment. Okay, we were just talking about your recent NSF project, but what are you working on now?
All right, so, well, I guess we talked a little bit about my interest in zoo archaeology, and that's a lot of what I did for graduate school, but and also sort of interest in human environment interactions. But over time, I had really the privilege of working in many sites in various types of environments, and so kind of what I been sort of more looking forward to is really connecting a lot of these spaces. And one of those ways is trying to study networks of interaction and networks of exchange in the past. And again, this is the influence of my mom here. Before she passed away, we began studying a series of parrot and macaws remains of these birds that were mummified and found in the Atacama Desert of northern Chile. Of course, that is one of the driest deserts in the world. So certainly this is not the habitat for these tropical species that you really find in more tropical environments. And so, yeah, we've been able, with Chilean colleagues, been able to study some of these birds using various techniques, including stable isotopes to get a better sense of their diet and to see if, you know, there was some influence of humans and evidence of humans feeding them specific foods. And they were feeding them maize that was fertilized with marine guano, which is basically bird poop, that is a very good fertilizer and was used by indigenous societies in the Atacama to really fertilize their soils. And I'm still interested in that topic, and we're still interested in studying some of these remains. And so over the last few years, we've been able to identify a few more from various research projects and collections, and we're continuing to study sort of these connections between these societies over great expanses of space.
Wow, that's really cool. That must have been so special, like getting to work with your mom on the project. And, you know, obviously she brings the ornithology side and you bring the archaeology side. That I can imagine that was really cool.
Yeah, indeed. And you know, this is, yeah, it's something that I have been able to, you know, I don't know, learn more about. And it also helps to connect these various regions and places where we conduct research. So I've also been able to do some research in Amazonia. And these societies, and today we see them very fragmented. A lot of these indigenous groups are reduced to communities, some articulated into broader organizations. But in the past, you know, they really transcended geographical borders. And so we also want to sort of emphasize the significance of these trans-regional polities and societies interacting with, you know, people moving from all sorts of directions and spaces in a very cosmopolitan sense.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So have you found, what have been the differences that have really stood out to you working in the different regions or working with different types of communities in different regions? Even though I know, obviously, you were just making the point that people moved all over and you're trying to focus on the connections, not the differences, but has it felt different working in the different regions, or has it been pretty similar?
Well, there's definitely differences. The landscapes, the geographies are different, and that can shape how one interacts with them, how one is getting acculturated. Certainly but overall, what I found is that, you know, people tend to be, you know, very friendly in all of these places, and generally interested in learning more about the past of their landscapes, about their past of their people. And I feel archaeology can do that, provide a little bit more information, enrich what they have, and in many cases reinforce things that they already knew. In others, you know, find new insights. And I'm very thankful for the career path that I've had. So. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So before I get to asking you about what you want to work on next, I do want to ask you also, I had a thought. Is there, in addition to this project, are there other projects that you're particularly excited about right now?
Yeah. So, well, last summer we published a paper where we just report on the finding of a new sort of terrace temple site associated with the expansion of the Tiwanaku state. And so part of what we're doing in the summer is going back to the site and doing some geophysical work and continuing to learn more about it. Initially we just reported it is its existence, but now we want to learn more about the site and its significance. And it seems to have been very important for mediating the exchange between a valley region that was very productive, particularly for maize, and the highlands, where at that point in time maize was not produced, at least not in large scale. There are some maize varieties that can grow in very high elevations, but they're very few. And so the site seems to have been important in mediating the flow of maize towards the Tiwanaku.
Yeah, that's again kind of going a little bit into that theme of movement and exchange. And yeah, it all ties together, right? Always. Yeah, and that there's an article, I think you just mentioned that we will include in the show notes about that effort. So if you're interested in learning more, definitely check out the show notes. It's got some beautiful pictures, and I like how it has an action shot of you like at the computer. of all things, I thought that was kind of funny. But it, you know, it shows some really good visuals on the site itself and the work that you were doing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. So when you're thinking back about, you know, all of your work over the years, what is there advice that you would give for people that are interested in doing this type of work, or anything that you would want to see changed about this type of work?
Well, I think that doing work internationally is always challenging. But there are ways of doing it, and engaging in collaborative relations is a very positive way. And the same is true with working with, you know, with local indigenous communities. It really is all about, you know, just being respectful and mindful of, you know, various norms and various ways that things are organized, and, you know, being flexible enough to really consider their needs, their wants, and trying to find sort of compromises and trade-offs into how to best approach these. So archaeological research has become more interdisciplinary and more collaborative over the years, and I think that's a really positive thing, as has been, you know, being able to engage all of these descendant communities, which in many cases are very interested and very open to engaging with various types of researchers, not just archaeologists, but all sorts of researchers, in as much as they can also benefit from knowledge production.
Yeah, so what are you really excited about? What are you looking forward to working on next?
I'd say more of that, just being able to return every year to the Andes for me is a treat. You know, I still have family there. My dad is in La Paz, and you know, being able to engage with our colleagues and collaborators, and those relationships are something that I really value. And I kind of like when I'm here over winter, especially, I miss the dryness and the high elevation. Mm-hmm. But I hope to continue doing that work. And I hope that it, you know, people still find it interesting and worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as someone else who works in dry highlands here in Colorado, you'll have to tell me if there's a secret that you found for elevation sickness.
Well, in the Andes, we have coca tea, but I don't think you can find that.
Alas, yeah, no coca tea in Colorado.
But yeah, I mean, obviously, just taking the time, taking a few days to adjust the elevation is always recommended. But yeah, the mountains, beautiful.
Yeah, it's very spoiled. But my colleague also lives in Pennsylvania, so every time she comes out here, it's like, whoa, it hits hard, the elevation, that's for sure. Anyway, so yeah, so is there anything, like, we're right at the end here, is there anything that, like, if you had a soapbox, you would scream to the masses that you would want them to know, you know, from your experience doing this type of work?
No, not particularly. I think it's been good. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we could continue going in various directions, talk about the specific projects, but I think we've covered quite a bit. And if anything, I'd be happy to talk again at some point. And
yeah, always more to talk about. Yeah, I mean, I feel like we could have gotten into a lot more with all the different animals and what you've learned about them and so many different things that would be fascinating. So we'll have to find an excuse to have you back on sometime.
Sure, sure.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. Very cool to get to hear about this work that is both very different in some ways than the work here in our area, and then in other ways, obviously very similar with two high, dry types of places. But yeah, always interesting and always fun for everybody when they get to hear about fuzzy, cute animals.
I mean, one thing that I guess we didn't mention, but at some point if it could be placed in, is the fact that we coordinate all of our research with the Bolivian Ministry of Cultures. So we are very grateful for all the support that they've provided to our research and all our all scientific foreign projects that occurred there. Yeah. But other than that, you know, it's been good.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Bolivian Ministry of Culture. Feliz cumple. To your late mom.
Thank you.
Thank you again for coming on and sharing. Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/heritagevoices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Play Music Store. Also, please share with your friends or write us a review. Sharing and reviewing helps more people find the show and gets the perspectives of Heritage Voices' amazing guests out there into the world. Don't we just need more of that in anthropology and land management? If you have any more questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. If you'd like to volunteer to be on the show as a guest or even a co-host, reach out to me as well, jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org. You can also follow more of what I'm doing on Facebook at Living Heritage Anthropology and the nonprofit Living Heritage Research Council, or on Twitter at Living Heritage A. As always, huge thank you to Lyle Belenqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.